This is EdgeCases. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
And our topic this week is When the Bubble Bursts.
Oh, this sounds fun.
Well, I'm not sure what we're going to be describing will be fun, but it might be interesting to talk about, sure. So I don't believe we have any follow-up, So I'm just going to get to it then. So the big question here about the bubble is, are we in a bubble, right? Are we, If we are in a bubble, what is it like? And by this, I mean the tech industry, and I probably mean something more specific than that, but we'll get to that in a bit. And if we are in a bubble, what does that mean for you and me? I've lived through one bubble, As of you, I'm assuming. I would be curious how many of our listeners are new enough that they didn't even go through that bubble very much, or what their economic situation has been like for the past couple of years. And if you haven't gone through anything like that, and you think you might be in danger of having some problems when this bubble bursts, I might be able to help you out with that. So we're gonna talk about that. Sort of the last thing will be Andrew's tips for surviving the bubble. So we'll see how that goes.
Are you a prepper?
A prepper? Like Dr. Prepper? What?
Do you know what a prepper is?
Like a end of the world prepper?
Yeah.
Well, do I have a cabin out in the wilderness stocked up with canned goods? No.
You don't have like a red shed in Wisconsin?
No, do you?
Well, yeah.
So yeah, maybe we'll have to ask you what your tips are for surviving the apocalypse. Well, we're not talking about the apocalypse. We're talking about a bust. And the last bust, for at least the tech industry, was around 2000. Or actually, more specifically, that was when I experienced it. I guess it took a couple of years for it to happen. But the first bubble that there have been bubbles forever, economic bubbles. But the one that we tended to go through as tech people who are now iOS and Mac developers was the dot-com bubble in the 90s. And let's see. The Wikipedia, I'm going to read from Wikipedia again, said it was about 97 to 2000 when that took place. It feels to me like the whole web kind of just when it even just got started building up like in the early 90s all the way. Like it was on a trajectory up the whole time, and then it crashed.
97 seems a bit early in my book, but I was thinking it's maybe late 98 type thing, but okay.
Well, I think, and it's true that you have to, maybe you want to distinguish between just a tech industry that was doing well versus a tech industry that was over exuberant and was setting itself up for a fall.
Well, was 97, was that when the bust began and by Wikipedia standards? Yeah. Or that's the bubble?
That's actually that's when they say the bubble was.
Okay.
So they don't.
I agree with that. Yeah.
They don't treat the bubble as when the dot-com started. Mm-hmm. They treat it later on. Now, I think you can probably go back and forth about that. I am not an economist, so I will not be able to give you authoritative pronouncements about that. Although that's not going to stop me from talking.
Economists can't. Yeah. Economists can't either. So.
So the 97 to 2000, and then it says the climax was on March 10th, 2000, when the Nasdaq peaked at 54,000. Mm-hmm. And I should have looked. I don't know if it's actually higher today. I looked at their little graph on Wikipedia that talked about the stock market, and it was striking that the stock market was going up and up and up gradually, but then that one spike around like 2000 was striking because it was just so much higher than anything before it or after it. And if you look at, because their little chart also went up to the present day, and this huge spike, and then it went back down, and then it started, it's been going up again, but it hasn't reached the same peak. So I guess that answers my question. Are we back to 5,400 on the NASDAQ? Probably not. But there were a lot of companies that died during that first round. And there were a lot of companies that we think of now as still being successful companies, which nosedived, at least on the stock market. When I was reading through the Wikipedia article, it said Cisco's stock declined by 86%. Amazon went from $107 to $7, although I think that said citation needed, so maybe that's not correct. But of course, Amazon has come roaring back. Cisco is, as far as I know, doing relatively well, although I guess I don't really know if I wanted to check up. But there are other companies, big companies that died. Sun basically died And I would say that a lot of times, a lot of the companies that died were companies that were not dot-com companies, which I'll get to in a second, were companies that relied on other dot-com companies to do their work. Like, they weren't companies that were succeeding because of economic merit in and of itself. They were all feeding on the trough, I guess you could call it, of dot-com companies that had gotten all this money from investors at that point. Mm. And so the companies that did badly were the ones that had been relying on that rather than on something else. And of course, one of the examples that I would bring up is companies like Apple, where they were dying for other reasons, I suppose. But they continued to grow and continued to do well, or start to do well, through that period because they weren't relying on all of that money, if I remember correctly. And so let's see. So the dot-com companies, reading a little further here, Canonical dot-com company's business model relied on harnessing network effects by operating at a sustained net loss to build up market share. Although what I think the idea was, well, they were all these companies that tried to do something trendy on the internet. And it wasn't necessarily that they couldn't make anything work. It was that the kinds of things they were trying to do were probably not going to work at that point. Mm-hmm. And so like pets.com, whatever it was, mm-hmm. that they were trying to sell like cat food and stuff mm-hmm. by sending it to you and through their website. And, you know, anybody could have come up with a business that would sell you stuff and then mail it to you, right? People have made a business like that. But I think the idea was that they were trying to make it trendy, and so they weren't really necessarily making the right business decisions around that. And so they were, you know, maybe selling it for less than it was worth, not making a profit on what they were doing, that sort of thing. But overall, a lot of those things that these companies tried to do are things that companies have since done successfully. And I think Amazon is a pretty good example that they sell, you know, everything over the internet, and they're still doing pretty well. So let's see. The stock market crash of 2000 to 2002 caused a loss of $5 trillion in the market value of companies. And that hurt those companies, and I think it hurt a lot of other people, because I think people, my impression is people got into the stock market for this because they thought, wow, you know, this seems like a sure thing and it's going up and up and up. And so I'll put some savings into that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. The other part of it, though, the other thing that probably affects us more is this idea that there were a lot of new developers, a lot of new tech people that came into the market because of this. People who were not programmers before, people who did not necessarily have CS degrees, said, oh, I can program HTML. You know, I can do all these things that need to get done for these companies. And so they came in and joined these companies. And then, of course, the companies went away, and then they went away as well. I heard a lot of stories about people, you know, going back to live with their parents from where, you know, wherever they had gone to, whatever big city they had gone to do this stuff. And so the concern is, if we're coming to that point again with the current tech boom, are we going to see these effects again? Are we going to see these negative effects on everybody? And so, you know, one question, is that going to happen again? And mm-hmm. of course, we can't really know, but we're going to speculate. And second, if it does, what can we do about it? Mm-hmm. And so there are a bunch of signs. I think the reason why I thought about doing this was because there are a lot of articles that you read about, and I don't necessarily read the paper anymore, but I see people link to these articles on Twitter about, oh, this or that crazy thing means that we're in another bubble. Mm-hmm. And so it's, I think I have a whole list of companies where the company got sold for a crazy amount, and that means we're in a bubble, right? And so the ones that I have listed here are Instagram. Mm-hmm. I think Instagram was the one that really got on my radar as the first one where people were saying, wow, that's just a whole lot of money for a company that isn't necessarily making money. Mm-hmm. That doesn't have a business plan. And so people were saying, well, that feels like the dot-com boom, the previous dot-com boom, because it's the same sort of thing, ridiculous valuation for a company that isn't making money. And when you talk about it in that generic way, then yes, that's true. On the other hand, Facebook seems to have be it's a different story. Because Facebook itself went public, right? And Facebook is that same sort of, you know, gather a lot of eyeballs, get yourself a giant network effect, and then kind of, you know, figure out from there how you're going to make a lot of money. But when they went public, it was not this exuberant rise of their stock. Their stock kind of languished. And I don't know what it is at now, but I remember reading stories about how, well, they didn't make as much money as they would have liked, or as people might have been expecting them to make. People were a little leery. They said, hey, you know, they don't necessarily have a story for we're going to make infinite amounts of money. No, people ran the numbers and said, well, you know, advertising isn't necessarily going to fuel explosive growth for them. And so that seems like a con. You know, the pro is, hey, Instagram was bought for a lot of money. The con is the people who bought them seem to be more grounded in terms of how the economy is treating them than otherwise. But let's see. So they also were the ones that bought WhatsApp, right? And WhatsApp for like $19 billion.
Yeah, I believe so.
And Oculus Rift, which I keep spelling with two C's. It's only one C. And that was for $2 billion. So again, hey, they're throwing all this money around. Does that mean we're in a boom? And maybe it does. But again, this feels less like, maybe you know of more examples. This feels less like a giant pattern of the whole industry going insane than, well, Facebook has a lot of money. And so they're doing these things that will shore up their business model, what they think of as their business model. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. That seems like a toss up for me. The last one that I was going to mention is Yo. Because they got a lot of money from investors, or he, I guess it's just one guy, got a lot of money from investors for an app which basically doesn't do anything. But when you look at the prices of the rest of the stuff, I think the idea was this guy got $200,000. So maybe he's gotten more since then. But it's still not quite the same as, you know, $1 billion for something. Mm-hmm. So again, I'm not quite sure that it's the same deal. I do know I've seen a lot of what we would have called back then dot-com companies. I don't know if we call them really dot-com companies anymore, but they're companies that have websites and are doing these, a lot of social stuff. I guess people just call it social. A lot of these little tiny companies that are doing, you know, some sort of, you know, they're going to be the next Facebook of whatever. And they seem, you know, not to have, I mean, most of them won't survive. And that's the way it's always been with startups. Most of them don't survive. Does the fact that there are a lot of these silly startups mean that we're in a bubble? Again, I'm not quite sure that it is like that. Let's see. So yeah, so Facebook is kind of a counterexample because their IPO didn't go crazy. I thought Twitter was also getting dinged for not having revenue or not having growth of users that investors really wanted. And I think Square was also recently got some bad press about, well, they're in a really competitive field. And so, you know, should we really be giving them lots more money running up their stock when it doesn't necessarily seem like slam dunk that they're going to survive either, or they're going to be a big success. And these sorts of articles, again, make me think, well, you know, what are we in? Because it isn't so exuberant that all these companies are just having an easy way of it. I have heard people talk about how Amazon still has a high valuation for its earnings. Have you heard people talk about this, Wolf?
I haven't, no.
I think people usually mention that. Maybe it's just Gruber, who knows. Mention this in contrast to the way Apple has its valuation, because Apple is making lots of money. It has more money than it knows what to do with. And yet their stock is sort of lower than what their earnings would seem to indicate that it should be.
Okay, yeah, now that you give me the context, I know what you're talking about, yeah.
So, but again, does that mean we're in a bubble? Like, wouldn't Apple be higher if we were in a bubble?
Good question.
But I think another way to look at it, because I've already beaten that particular aspect of this to death, is maybe we're in different bubbles. Because mobile really seems to have changed a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Because before it was just, well, you have a website and that's kind of it. And, you know, maybe you have an app. But for the most part, if you're a dot-com company, you have got a website and that's it. And now there are companies which seem to be making a lot of money with mobile that are not necessarily the same companies that are making a lot of money with web, or that are trying to make a lot of money. And maybe most of these startups have to have a mobile strategy. But it seems to me that, when people talk about a mobile bubble or an app store bubble, they're talking about the people who made a lot of money with apps on Apple's app store at the beginning or wherever, even up to right now. People that just seem to really have a giant hit there. And it feels like it's a bit something a bit different. It does impact us as iOS developers more, possibly, than whether all these websites survive. But it feels different. Because the people making that kind of money are selling to consumers. And so they're not making money because investors have thrown money at them to for crazy business plans. They made money because they made an app that did something. And I guess sometimes people say that the apps were silly, like the person who made an app which was $1,000 that didn't do anything, right?
Mm-hmm. I am rich.
Right. And so I guess somebody bought that, right?
At least one person did.
At least one person. But again, that just feels kind of different. And so if it's a different kind of bubble, is the fact that bubble seems to be going down, deflating, a different experience, a different phenomenon? Because I think it is, we are seeing signs that people are leaving leaving the mobile bubble, that's hard to say. There was an article or a web blog post on the web blog called Timecode, and I don't have the person's actual name down there, called Any Port in a Storm, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. It's subfurther.com. And there he talks about, you know, a whole bunch of these people who are going to Apple, for example, who are leaving the indie field for more secure pastures. Kevin Hochter, am I saying that right?
Yeah.
A bunch of other people going to Apple. I don't know the names offhand. And there are also, I think, people who are saying, well, I'm not making as much money on the App Store as I used to. And so that, you know, the gold days are over for people who wanted to do that. And then, so what do they do now? But is that really a bubble bursting? And if it is or if it isn't, then what do you do about it? I would tend to say that for me, it's more interesting and more useful to restrict the bubble to just about the investment storm that I was talking about earlier, because that bubble can burst in a very sudden way. Because what happens is, if there are all these internet companies and all these other companies that are feeding off of the internet companies, the way that cycle ends is when the investors say enough. They say, well, we're going to stop funding these guys right now because we no longer have that irrational exuberance that they're all going to make tons of money. We kind of now figured out that they're not all going to make tons of money, so we're going to stop funding them. They're going to die. And then the ecosystem dies with it. The people who are other websites that are, you know, giving services to the first set of websites, they die. The contracting companies, the services that were making money based on the fact that there was all this money coming in from investors, they die. And it's just this giant die-off of a lot of places in the industry. As opposed to, well, now the source of income has gone down for people due to user actions or due to a glut of apps. Although I do think that the similarity between them is that in both cases there's a glut, I guess. Because when there's only a small number of companies out there with unrealistic business plans, it's more likely that at least some of those will survive, or they'll survive in a less crowded market. And I think that it's sort of similar with apps, but it isn't. I don't think it is the same phenomenon. And this is actually going relatively quickly.
Don't worry, I have a lot of comments.
Okay. All right. So if we are going to have that die-off as opposed to a gradual fade of something, that's when I think it's useful to start thinking about, well, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
During this, the thing that we're seeing, and again, it's a bunch of different factors put together, but the thing that we're seeing is that the rest of the economy isn't doing that well.
Right.
And so if you say, well, I'm in the tech industry now, and I'm making a lot of money now, and I seem to have a really great career ahead of me now, and then the industry tanks, well, what do you do after that? Because you look around and say, well, what other industries are doing well that I can go into and keep making this lifestyle? Well, you're not going to find that many. So what can you do about it? And I think all of my suggestions tend to come down to be conservative be more conservative than you might think that you could be. And in some degree, that's also my, what I tend to be like in a lot of ways, that I will not be one to just, the example I think of is bungee jumping, right? Have you ever gone bungee jumping?
I have not.
Yeah. Well, you know, you have to have a lot of faith in you have to have a lot of optimism to be like, okay, this is a good idea, right, to do it. Now, of course, you know, you can try to make it more conservative by only going with companies that have a really good safety record, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, if you really want to be conservative, you're just not going to jump off of, you know, a bridge, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see how that plays out. But, okay, so let's see. I'm just going to go through these real quick. I would tend to say that, you know, you don't want to be placing a lot of bets on stuff if you think this is going to be coming up. So if you are making a lot of money, you know, pay off your loans now. I know with a lot of people coming up these days, they've got really, really high college bills, right? Mm-hmm. And that there are a lot of people who are not tech industry people who just are finding it incredibly difficult to pay off those bills. Because I don't think, and you can't like declare bankruptcy and get rid of them now. That there's,
right.
You know, it gets really. I don't know how people are going to deal with it these days. And so, if you have the money to pay them off now, maybe you want to pay them off instead of, you know, getting the car or getting the big screen TV or whatever, if you can. And again, that's something where you might say, oh, you know, do I have to? And it might be something really difficult for you to accept as a kid. But it's if you get, you know. Look at the fact that you're just making all this money in an economy that's really bad. You're already ahead of the game with a lot of people, and it's better if you don't squander it. I had also, I don't know how well this is going to come across. Don't get attached to trappings of wealth. So that's a little, I don't know, maybe that's a little going too far, but because there are a lot of companies, like the companies that you hear about that survived the first dot-com bubble are companies that were able to divest themselves of their growth.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of companies that, like services companies that bought up little shops in many cities around the country. They were called roll-ups, not fruit roll-ups, just roll-ups. And when the dot-com boom happened, they had to divest themselves of all of these offices and, you know, lay off all these people. And so I'm not sure it was such a great idea to hire them in the first place. I'm not sure that services scale the way they were hoping that they would. But at least they had sort of discrete things that they could get rid of and go back to being one company at the end and, you know, maybe survive that way. In the same sort of way, if the money goes away so that you can no longer get the six-digit salary, whatever, you know, you may need to, you know, even if you are enjoying the life right now, you've already bought all this stuff, you might as well enjoy it. You know, be ready for the day when that might not be there anymore. It's what I would describe anyway. Let's see.
So can I kind of boil that down to buy a compound bow and learn to enjoy the taste of venison?
No, I wouldn't go that far. No, I mean, you're the one with the shed. I'm not the one with the shed.
I'm years ahead of you, man.
I mean, but you can get a less, you know, without needing to live off the land. You can get a job that will still get you by and will still save you money without it needing to be a dot-com job, I think. Let's see. And the last one was in terms of those jobs, you know, if right now you're working at a dot-com company that's really, you know, or a services company that's relying on that kind of money, you may want a plan B. And I think that's what a lot of, again, whether those people are doing it because of the dot-com boom or because of the mobile boom, you know, the people who are going to Apple, the people who are going to some other big company, you know, Apple is probably, since they sell to consumers, they will probably survive this, and they're gigantic and they're all over the world. They will probably survive this. I know that with the last bubble that burst, which was not the dot-com bubble, but the housing bubble,
mm-hmm.
from what I've heard from people, that did affect the tech industry in places. Because, you know, lots of people didn't have money anymore, so they couldn't pay for services or whatever. But Apple didn't even feel it. It didn't feel mm-hmm. like there were no layoffs for Apple. So, you know, hey, if you can get a gig at Apple, or if you know people at Apple, it might be good to be exploring that. But the trouble is, I can't tell you, well, do it now, because I don't know when it's going to happen. So again, the way I phrase it is have a plan B, be thinking about a plan B. Don't necessarily put it into action, you know, only buy the compound bow if you already like to hunt. But having something around is just to think about it. A lot of times with these sorts of things, when you do get hit with bad news, like the last bust, especially with us, when you know, a lot of us are doing very well right now, the biggest initial hurdle is mental. It's just getting your mind around the fact that things have changed in a way that you didn't think were going to happen. And so even just thinking through a plan B in the abstract might help you to get more ready for that. I think that's actually pretty much all I have.
Okay, do you want to share how the dot-com bust affected you personally?
I can talk about it a little bit. I was actually at one of those roll-up companies. And actually, was I at more than one? I had, you know, I think the way I've put it to people in person is I've had a couple of horses shot out from under me. And I scrambled a bit, and I found a port in the storm to survive that during that time period. And, you know, maybe it was less exciting work, but it got me through it. Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty much all I've got for that. There was still enough tech work to keep me in business. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I suspect that there will be enough tech work for the people who are dedicated and who say, you know, I want to stay in this industry. I'm willing to, you know, do something which is less sort of groundbreaking, willing to move somewhere else, maybe. Mm-hmm. I do suspect a decent number of people will move out of San Francisco.
Yeah.
When the money train comes into the station, leaves the station, whatever that metaphor would go. So yeah, actually, those two things would be the first ones that I would recommend, just from my experience. And you know, I never did, you know, I never bought the mansion the first time around. I haven't bought the mansion the second time around. That's probably the way to go as well. So you know, just being a little more conservative about it was basically what got me through. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for me, it was I like you. I think it was because of my independent status. I often have the buffers pretty well allocated. And so that's because contracting tends to be kind of up and down, feast and famine type stuff. Sure. It's always good to have kind of, you know, be able to get through the winter type stuff. So
with for the bow.
with your bow, yes, in your red shed. And with the dot-com bust, how it affected me is that I was doing both Mac and web development at the time. And things slowed down. I was doing okay, but I was quite worried about it. And I remember that that was, and I was wondering whether or not the Mac work would actually be able to sustain me. I was worried that clients would, this was 2000, right? So this is, I think, even before the iMac shipped. I forget exactly when that happened, but, you know, Apple, you know, it was not iPod Apple yet. You know, they were definitely not sure that they were coming out of this. And there was a lot of disinvestment in the Apple software platform.
Right. Yes. People didn't want to write for the Mac anymore.
Right. And that actually worked out pretty well for me because while the pond got smaller, a lot of fish left. And right. So mm-hmm. there were fewer. So if you still had a Mac app that your business was running on, and there were fewer programmers willing to work on to write Mac software. So my phone kept on ringing, but I was seriously worried about it. And it got to the point where I joined the Microsoft Developer Network, and I bought a white box PC, wow. And I fired up Visual Studio, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to learn this stuff because I need to have a plan B.
Yeah,
I never got to the point where I actually was seeking out contracts for that, but I want to already have it in my back pocket if push came to shove.
You are a living example of my advice.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So it was also good because I got to see how much Visual Studio rocked compared to a Project Builder
so
back then.
It's so good, isn't it? Yes. Oh. I mean, it really, yeah. I still wish that Apple felt that Visual Studio was more of a competitor than they probably do right now. Mm-hmm.
I haven't used it in years. I don't know how they've improved it yet even more, but it was pretty great back then.
Well, do they actually need to have improved it much to still be better than Xcode
today?
That's
a good question. It's really a pretty great app.
It is. I think it is a good question. I think Xcode has made a lot of progress in a lot of areas, but it would be curious to find that out. But that wasn't the point of what you were talking about.
Right. So I have a bunch of topic bullet points here based on what you said. Initially, we used to talk about Cisco and Sun and the other dealers that are kind of like feeding off the dot-com hype and all that. I always kind of think of those guys as ARM dealers, that they're like supplying the hardware for the war.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I think Quest famously kind of created along with the bust. They basically bought a bunch of dark fiber and they really invested in a lot of infrastructure.
Yeah.
But right when everyone said, okay, maybe this internet thing isn't working out.
Right.
So yeah. So right. It kind of leads into another point. So Mark Andreessen wrote this. I looked it up while you were talking, and it looks like he wrote it for the Wall Street Journal. It's an essay back in August 20th, 2011. Maybe it's also elsewhere, it looks like. But anyway, this is what the Google first hit. And the title of his essay is Why Software is Eating the World. And it's a good article with a lot of different facets in it. But essentially, I'll boil it down to his assertion that today's dominant companies are all software companies. That software is more and more... In order to be a successful company, you have to be a software company, or at least if you're not a software company, at least you have a large component, you have to be at least good at software somehow, or at least it needs to factor in big in your plans. And I buy into his argument. And so it's almost not, even if mobile wasn't huge, and I'll talk a little bit about that, but like it definitely strikes me as it when I drive down the street and I look at these skyscrapers, I'm pretty sure I could walk into any floor of them, and I would be useful for them because I know how to write software.
If you could get past security.
That's always the problem with me. Mm-hmm. That compound bow really sets off alarms.
You think? I mean, there's lots of different kinds of software. You just mean in terms of being a developer at all?
Yeah, pretty much. It's like this entire, as a contractor / mercenary kind of guy, and as like we talked about domain tourism in previous episodes. I'm used to walking into a company who needs some sort of software written and kind of like doing matrix style brain uploads where I learn about what they need done and I do it. And so it's kind of weird. It's like it's almost as if like software itself is almost a meta skill, or development is like a meta skill that's not useful in its own right, but you can then shape it to be useful for the task at hand. But so while I like the idea and I think that it has merit to Andreessen's idea here, I also remember when the cover of Wired magazine with the yellow cover and the big happy sunflower on it. Call and the title of it was The Long Boom, right when I think it's still on the shelf. That was back when Wired started feeling like a phone book, or maybe like volume 3 of Inside Macintosh. It was starting to get big because everyone's running their ads in there.
Right.
And it was definitely an icon of that era. So it also reminds me of when you were talking about that, the final dot-com boom spike. It was definitely one of these things where I'm sure there's probably some sort of name for the psychology here, but it strikes me that there seems to be like this this dynamic where like there's a person who might be interested in investing in the .com and he doesn't do it, and he hears about going up and hears and now his friend gets rich and now his next friend gets rich and hears about it going up more, and each time he's like saying nah, and like always kind of kicking himself that he's not investing. And finally, this gets to the point, like I'm such an idiot. I can't believe I haven't invested yet. Everyone's getting rich. I'll do it net. And unfortunately, everyone says that at the same time. And that, of course, is the bust, the malinvestment, the overinvestment. And that's when everything collapses.
What's the thing with, like, the tulip?
Yeah, Holland tulip craze, I want to say.
Like something Dutch, in the 1600s, where that was, like, the first documented case of people trying to putting too much value in something that was really obviously not worth that much.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was tulips, right? It was, people thought that flowers were going to appreciate in value. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now we can say, well, that's crazy. And I think in 10 years, people come back around and say, yeah, we were maybe putting too much investment in the, you know, mobile or web or whatever, mm-hmm. that it was just obviously not going to provide the returns that people wanted. And of course, what is going to provide those returns anymore? Again, the economy is not doing that well. You can't have, you know, whatever, these things that are growing, you know, the tech industry or the financial industry, you can't have them sitting on top of a weak economy and still expect them to grow like crazy, at least not for mm-hmm. forever.
Mm-hmm. Although, also, just because it looks like a bust to us doesn't necessarily is a bust. I mean, technically, by the definition, is a bust. But, look where the web is now today. And it went through a bust, but it was at like a downshifting. And it has since revved back up. I don't know if it's at the same, you know, it's kind of hard to measure apples to apples there, just in terms of inflation and also this media hype, because the web was obviously big in media hype back then. Now, this, you know, everyone knows that everyone has a website and everyone can access the web, and what's a big right. deal? Mm-hmm. So, but I wouldn't be surprised if the web isn't much larger now, financially, economically, than it was maybe at the height of the boom level. It's
right. Well, it's doing more real work than it used to.
Right. And another thing I want to mention is that you were talking about like cutting costs, kind of getting conservative, kind of, you know, taking stock of your life so that you kind of, if things go south or things go sideways, you already have a plan. You can execute that plan B. You also mentioned that people will probably be moving out of San Francisco during this. And yeah, so if you're in San Francisco, this is hard. I have this theory about San Francisco that it's kind of a perfect storm in terms of, like, it's almost like a petri dish or maybe an experiment of some sort. It has all these interesting inputs. Number one, there's more and more tech people living in San Francisco, and tech people kind of tend to be kind of work obsessed, maybe workaholics, and obviously they're being well paid, and they tend to be mostly single. And these dynamics kind of play interestingly, that you have kind of single people that I guess that are kind of that are very well paid, so there's not like they're putting money into a kid's college fund, right? And so they have a lot of disposable income, so they don't mind if an extra $1,000 a month goes towards rent, and it ends up kind of feeding on itself, where it's the people, like, you know, with families, and they don't have these tech jobs, they're obviously being pushed out. I know there's a lot of I was trying to find the article while you were talking, but I couldn't bring it up. But the quote that I remember was this woman complained that San Francisco is becoming the bedroom community for Silicon Valley.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. There was an article maybe a year ago from a woman who, Rebecca something, where she talked about the buses as kind of mm-hmm. a symbol of the changes that things were going on.
We're talking about the same
person. I think we are. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, of course, San Francisco is it's not, you know, it's not just the poster boy for this sort of thing. San Francisco mm-hmm. has its own very particular history that has a bunch of factors that are playing into this. They're kind of anti-growth,
right,
in a way that keeps them from building enough housing for everyone being there.
Mm-hmm.
I also tend to think that it's easy to give too much credence, give too much weight to these particular factors. I mean, the number of people moving into San Francisco for tech jobs is still not, it's not like another million people, right? It's still a relatively small number in terms of the whole city. So it's not like a city's being overrun. Oh my God. It's just, they're having an economic effect, but they're not changing everything about the city and about what it is. So I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like, you know, saying, oh, it's going to change the city because there are more unmarried people there. I don't think that's a direct impact for that. I think what the impact is when it already has a very small amount of rental properties, that, you know, the number of people coming in for that is overwhelming that small number. Whereas if there were a lot of rental places in the city, then the number of people coming in would have less of an impact. It's that San Francisco is uniquely vulnerable to that, rather than that it's such a giant tidal wave, I think.
Mm-hmm. And so you were talking about the loans have been hard to pay off. And obviously with San Francisco rent being so high and climbing, it's pretty hard to pay off those loans. So it's easy to conceive of a plan B, but it's also, even among tech people, it's kind of hard for you to actually put aside serious money for a plan B to build up those buffers, because more and more of your money is going towards rent.
Well, and it's not just San Francisco. I mean, the Valley is also expensive.
Right.
It has been since I've been here. Mm-hmm. It's interesting hearing some people who are kind of on Twitter as Cocoa developers who kind of talk about how much they don't like the Valley at all. They kind of see themselves as outsiders from the Valley, even though they're very tech savvy and, you know, would fit in if they were here, and yet they don't want to be here. And so, yeah, in terms of, you know, the plan B may be to get out now if mm-hmm. you can find a way to do that. The plan B may just be to know where you would go if you are going to get out. Because there are a lot of other nice places that have lower standards of living. But I think saying, well, my plan B is going to be wait for everybody else to leave and then I'll be good. The trouble with that approach is if you say, well, I'll wait till the economy tanks and then I'll be in great shape. Yeah, but you're waiting for the economy to tank and there's no guarantee you're still going to have a job.
Right.
At the end of that. That would not be my plan B if I were these people.
Soros who has the quote that the market can be irrational longer than you can stay solvent?
I haven't heard that quote. Yeah.
I think it was him, but I'm not sure. Finally, I know we're kind of running along here, but I will say that so I view the smartphone revolution and mobile as being pretty huge. If you look at the history of the PC revolution, it had a good 20-year run maybe from the dawn of the PCs to Microsoft, the Sony, everything kind of slowing down maybe. And not everyone had a PC. It was shared. Everyone's getting a smartphone. It's on a more rapid upgrade cycle. And I think I think we got at least a good 20 years out of it. And it's not kind of dot-com-y. I don't think it's going to super bust on us because everyone just keeps on buying smartphones. And you also have emerging markets where you have the next million people buying smartphones. Whether that translates into indie apps, I don't think so. It seems that free apps are the way to go. And I think that might be one of the reasons why you have Facebook having, buying up everything because that's where the money is. The advertiser where the money is. Yeah. And so the smartphones are and the mobile is huge. And between that, I think that even if smartphones weren't such a huge factor, that's with software in the world, there's a huge demand for more programmers. So thus, in terms of body counts, the United States has not been producing nearly enough programmers for a very long time. And that's shifting, and I think it's not just the United States thing. I think worldwide, there's more software engineers being educated and created to fulfill these roles. But it's right now we're sitting pretty, and I don't see that changing in the next 5 years. I think we at least have that much runway. But that was only if you go with the software in the world type thing. That with smartphones as well, I see what you're talking about with centralization, about kind of like these indie apps. It almost feels like the era of the indie developer is dead, which is it seems almost very ironic considering that never before have more people had computers and access to software technology. But there seems to be a centralization coalescing of the power to these large providers for better or for worse. And I would argue mostly for worse. But So I don't go out and buy your compound bow yet, if you don't already have one, I guess. But have that plan B. I think you and I can agree on that.
Okay, what it does kind of sound like you're saying that there won't be a need for the market to contract because there will always be a need for programmers. And I think
maybe I won't say always, but along those lines, yes.
in the larger scheme of things, sure, but I think there's going to be a local contraction
for web
and mobile developers that you're gonna want to be ready for, because it is going to affect people.
Yeah, that's pretty much the downshifting of the .com bust. Yeah.
All righty. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So if that's it.
That's it.
All right, that's it for me too, and we'll see you next time.